Welcome. The peace revolution now continues.
Breaker, breaker, 1-9. I'm in outer space with a microphone.
Imagine a club where presidents, prime ministers, and international bankers rub shoulders, and where royalty's on hand to make sure everyone gets along. Where the people running wars, the markets, and Europe say what they never dare to in public. Welcome to the world of Bilderberg, the most exclusive and secretive club in the world.
When you're doing good, you do it in the sunshine. When you do evil, you do it in the darkness.
I'm absolutely forbidden from discussing anything that has been said on any specific subject by any individual.
Every time I raise the issue of Bilderberg, I get sent from pillar to post.
I don't think that conspiracy is accurate, actually. I think if Bilderberg were a conspiracy, I wouldn't be talking to you.
Meets just once a year. Its cast list is a who's who of transatlantic political and corporate power. There's one important rule. No one who goes is able to say what was discussed or even who was there. For almost 50 years, Bilderberg has operated unnoticed. Even now, few people know it exists. Jim Tucker's trying to change that.
If 120 film stars or 120 football players went behind closed doors for 3 days, all newspapers would bust their butts trying to find out what happened. If 120 of the world's most powerful men, leaders in international finance, heads of state, high officials of the U.S. government, get together behind closed doors, armed guards for 3 days, why is there no curiosity?
Jim is a veteran right-wing journalist who's been tracking Bilderberg for the last 2 decades. He's convinced that it meets in secret because it's got something to hide.
Well, when you're doing good, you do it in the sunshine. When you do evil, you do it in the darkness. For some reason, it's critical that the world not know what transpires behind those closed doors.
You really think they're evil?
Yes.
Conspiracy theorists like Jim Tucker believe Bilderberg is a shadow government secretly trying to control the world. We wanted to find out the truth. This year's Bilderberg was being held in mid-May, and we wanted to be there. The organisers had promised to tell us where it was being held, but Jim alerted us first about a hotel in Versailles.
Bonjour, réservation s'il vous plaît.
Oui. Service réservation, Fabienne, bonjour.
Bonjour, I'd like to reserve a room, if possible, on the 15th and 16th of May.
I'm sorry, but the hotel is closed for this date.
It's closed?
Yes.
Right. What, is it a conference or something? Or I've tried to book before.
Well, closed,
and it's never, sure. You're just closed?
Yeah.
Is this the Bilderberg Conference Hotel?
No, I don't know what is the Bilderberg Conference. So.
Right. But there's no one staying there. I mean, the hotel is
no.
Just going to be closed
yeah.
for the whole weekend.
Yeah.
Thank you anyway.
You're welcome, sir.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We weren't the only people who were interested in Bilderberg. Mainstream politicians have now begun asking tough questions about the organisation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tomorrow in Versailles, as far as I can tell, the meeting of Bilderberg will begin. Now, the reason I raise this question is there have been a number of commissioners, Commissioner Monti, Lekkonen...
The Irish Green MEP, Patricia McKenna, presses the European Parliament to find out which of the powerful European commissioners will be at this year's Bilderberg. She's worried about Europe's political elite cozying up with big business for 3 days of secret discussions.
And every time I raise the issue of Bilderberg, I get sent from pillar to post. I should have had a reply on the 25th of April. I still have not got a reply. The Bilderberg meeting is starting at the weekend.
Patricia McKenna is part of the anti-globalisation lobby, who believe the world is run for the benefit of multinational companies. She sees Bilderberg as a useful way for big business to get its own way.
the kind of Europe that they want is basically a Europe which pursues the current policy on free trade, which ignores the criticism of the anti-globalization campaigners around the world, which has a policy that's geared towards multinational capital, the interests of the multinationals, because when you look at it, the people who are taking part in these meetings are key players in the multinational industries, and it's in their interest that the Bilderberg meetings take place.
We arrived in Paris the day that Bilderberg was due to start. We headed straight for the hotel, which we had been told was closed. Police with machine guns now patrolled the perimeter. I headed for the entrance, where smart men in black suits, sunglasses and discreet earpieces were closely checking everyone going into the hotel grounds.
Hi.
I speak just a little.
Yeah, I'm from the BBC. I've got my press card, but that's...
Press card? Hello.
Is this for the Bilderberg conference? Is this all the...
It's for the conference, yes.
Right. And is there... there's no chance that we can come in and have a look? I'm from BBC.
I know, but it's not possible you're here.
Right. And there's no... the whole hotel is closed off, isn't it?
It's closed. Hotel, closed.
We join the other spectators, a handful of journalists and conspiracy theorists who were explaining to the locals what was going on.
Rockefeller, Rothschild, Wallenberg, Beatrix de Hollande,
we knew the meeting would be full of bankers and the heads of multinational companies, but spotting them would be tough. There were only a few familiar faces in a fleet of modest Renault hatchbacks ferrying guests into the safety of the hotel. For 50 years, Bilderberg has kept its affairs private. There are no public records, and Bilderberg's own archives are embargoed. The only information we can be sure of come from the files of the former Labour leader Hugh Gaitskill, taken during Bilderberg meetings in the 1950s.
Hello? Ah, yes, Hugh Wilford here.
In a drab London University office block, the historian Dr. Hugh Wilford shows me the archive where Gaitskill hoarded everything from the first conference in 1954 at the Bilderberg Hotel in Holland.
Yeah, if I could order some additional items from the Gaitskill papers, please. Some items.
Inside the copious manila folders is everything from the helpful Dutch guide to windmills to Gaitskill's pad with detailed notes about all of the conference speakers. In his letters, Bilderberg's secrecy was laid bare for the first time.
We found this letter. What's this one?
This is from Hugh Gaitskill to his friend and Labour Party colleague Dennis Healy, in which he's telling him about the conference. He describes it as a rather special kind of conference, very hand-picked, with the proceedings private, and ends by saying that he hopes that he'll be able to give Healy further details. But meanwhile, would you please treat the whole matter as absolutely confidential, say nothing about it to anybody.
So real secrecy from the very beginning.
Yes.
Because you can see when you hear about the way that it's set up, why people have these conspiracy theories.
Yes, now I can quite see why that is the case, and the fact that so much secrecy was insisted upon for these early meetings. And yes, I mean, it doesn't necessarily look very good to the, you know, leader of the British Labour Party is consulting with various representatives of the secret services and American capitalists, and doing so in such a clandestine fashion. So yes, I can see why conspiracy theories have sprung up and surrounded Bilderberg.
Here's another interesting, another paper from the first one. It's about the European Union. It's interesting here saying, some sort of European Union has long been a utopian dream, but the conference was agreed that it is now a necessity of our times. Only in some form of union can the free nations of Europe achieve a moral and material strength capable of meeting any threat to their freedom.
Yeah.
So this is 50 years ago saying we must have a European Union.
Yes. But again, reflecting the fact that many of the people involved in planning, Bilderberg had also played leading roles in getting the European movement going in the late 1940s and early 50s. And the fact the Americans want it so much as well, because they want a stronger Western Europe to resist possible Soviet aggression.
What the Prime Minister fails to mention is that both he and the Chancellor were at Bilderberg when they were in opposition. The Tory MP, Nicholas Winterton, believes no one in government wants to talk about the group.
I asked, I think, two or three questions and got a totally negative reply. In my view, it's quite clear that nobody wishes to talk about Bilderberg and those that take part in their meetings.
What bothers Eurosceptics like Nicholas Winterton is the Europhile tendency of Bilderberg. He wants to know what elected European politicians are saying in their lengthy private discussions with powerful, unelected, unaccountable corporations.
I'm not saying that what they're doing is illegal. I'm saying it is somewhat sinister, and bearing in mind they're such powerful people, why are they not prepared to be more open about the subjects that they discuss and perhaps even the decisions that they reach following these discussions?
There is a peaceful solution called Peace Revolution. Now let's take back America. There's a war and we're in it. I know we can win it. So let's take back America. There was a dream, so believe it, and get ready to receive it. Now let's take back America.
Welcome to the Peace Revolution Podcast. I'm your host and navigator, Richard Grove, and this is where we step out of the confusion, fear, and anxiety of everyday life to relax into some knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. You're listening to Podomatic's number one rated podcast in higher education. Thank you for making time in your busy schedule to tune in and grow in the light direction. Peace Revolution and all the educational media we create here at TragedyandHope.com is presented as a public service without corporate sponsorship and is published commercial-free and presented free to the public. Thanks to the generosity of the subscribers to the Tragedy and Hope online community and the hard work of the media hosts featured at TragedyandHope.com. I encourage you to check the episode notes, references, and links for this and all episodes we publish at peacerevolution.org. I also invite you to click the invitation link in the episode notes and participate in the Tragedy and Hope online community, wherein over 1,000 thinkers from all over the world are engaging in a fear-free zone of mutual respect, individually sharpening our own intellectual self-defense skills and practicing the universal arts of liberation. Also in the notes for this episode, if you're interested in helping us continue producing the highest quality publications, there's a donation link for The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, which is our new multi-DVD interview project currently in post-production, and with over 5 hours of interview footage, this is a collection of educational material which is truly invaluable. If for some reason the donation link won't work for you, you can use any of the donate buttons on the side of any of our sites. It all goes to the same place. Those who donate $50 or more towards the completion of this project will receive the entire DVD set as our way of saying thanks. As an update on that project, we should be shipping the DVDs in a few weeks. And for those of you with one of those newfangled Blu-ray players, we're also creating a Blu-ray version of this interview in high definition. And details on how you can acquire the DVD set will be in an upcoming podcast. I'll also be including a few short clips of my interview with John Taylor Gatto during today's introduction of this episode, because I think his words will really provide a clear context, a magnifying lens, if you will, through which you can focus in on the magnitude and detail of the topic at hand. That being the history of eugenics in America and how the concepts and beliefs held by some, calling themselves the elect, have the privilege of being justified sinners, as their beliefs reflect that they are above the rest of us, in the so-called evolutionary chain of command. But before we get too deep into the episode, I should mention that if, after listening to today's episode and clicking your way through the notes, you'd still like to know more, Peace Revolution also has several partner podcasts, including Media Monarchy, Corbett Report, Gnostic Media, The School Sucks Podcast, and Remedy Radio, all of which lead by example and are likewise commercial-free and funded by those who find their media to be of value in today's world. Today's episode is a recipe for understanding the myriad of perspectives which comprise the concept of eugenics. And even though I opened this episode with a sample of a 2003 BBC interview on the Bilderberg Group, I only use that to briefly illustrate the point that those who are running the eugenics movements of today have been successfully meeting in secret for over 50 years, as the Bilderberg Group's own artifacts and archives reflect. To address the general grammar of today's episode, the concept of eugenics is the, quote, applied science or biosocial movement which advocates the use of practices aimed at improving the genetic composition of a population, end quote. And within today's episode, we're specifically focusing in on the application of eugenics to the human population. To employ a metaphor, the eugenicists are ranchers, and the general population is livestock, which the ranchers seek to control, specifically through breeding techniques and scientifically engineering an artificial environment to produce more livestock, which meet the specifications as dictated by the ranchers. Eugenics is not just a racial idea. It's part of a complex philosophy held by our common opposition. And instead of dehumanizing the eugenicists, I think it more prudent that we take some time and try to observe the history which they've created and identify why they do what they do and why they seek not only to control our education and economic systems, but to control our life systems. The concept of bionomics, ruling life itself, playing God, while at the same time they are denying God. And yet, from a different perspective, the concept of eugenics can be analyzed through the popular myth instilled through our public education system that Abraham Lincoln freed the slaves, and that the Civil War was about ending slavery. Because in this case, this myth is not a metaphor. It's not being used to educate you. It is merely a cleverly placed lie. More specifically, it's propaganda. You see, to share information with the intent of empowering, that's education. To share information with the intent of disempowering is propaganda. A myth is an untruth used to instruct through a process of abstraction, which is also a metaphor. A metaphor, when used to obstruct truth, is a lie or propaganda. Now that we've clarified this, I would like to share something for the benefit of your understanding, and I'm not asking you to believe me, and I'm not asking you to like what I say. Just try to understand the facts of the matter for yourself. Abraham Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation did not free any slaves under Lincoln's management. It did not affect any slaves living in the United States or in any town which was controlled by the Union. On the contrary, Lincoln did claim to free the slaves held by Confederate states, which were by definition not his over which to legislate. If Lincoln's intention was to free the slaves and end slavery, would he not have freed the slaves and ended slavery in the states over which he was president? Instead, during a time of war, he claimed to free the slaves only of the Confederate states, and this was a psychological warfare technique intended to undermine the solidarity of the South, and it worked. The Emancipation Proclamation was a propaganda document, and the claims made therein were null and void as pertaining to Confederate states. And yet, the only slaves Lincoln was claiming to free were those in Confederate states, not yet controlled by the Union. To help illustrate this point, here's a clip from The Ultimate History Lesson, A Weekend with John Taylor Gatto, where we're discussing the myth of the Civil War being fought to bring an end to slavery.
The Civil War changed that. We're sold that it was a great crusade against slavery by the school system. The major historians who've turned their attention to that say, I mean, to a person, that slavery was already dead. It was staggering through its last couple of generations, not because of a moral transformation on the part of plantation owners, but because the wives of the plantation owners were scratching their head and saying, you know, the boss, my husband vanishes for a couple of days. We have all these new slaves and they're not black anymore. They're various shades of brown. So I'm thinking right now, I think Vern Parrington, but a number of historians 50 years ago said slavery was on its last legs because the Southern womanhood wouldn't stand for it any longer. Russia, I believe, had freed the serfs. Britain and the continent had done this thing. We were going to do it too. But it gave a nobility to the necessity to get rid of the Southern politicians who were trained in dialectical thinking, in rhetoric, and could run circles around the Northern politicians in Congress. They could produce the most compelling arguments for this or that. And so the South had to be gotten rid of.
From my understanding, those dry goods like cotton from the South that were produced by slaves were then going to factories in the North. And the factory owners in the North figured out that the slave owners were paying too much overhead. It cost a lot to keep a whole family fed, etc. And there were letters exchanged, and they actually discovered it was cheaper. Why not make everyone a slave who doesn't know that they're a slave?
A wage slave.
Right.
And think only about the welfare idea. If you have a plantation family and you require harmony, even though some people are very subordinate, if somebody gets sick or too old to work, you can't in fact do the Simon Legree bit and get rid of them, or what happens is morale collapses. So you have to care for them. The discussions on the highest level among Northern industrialists, why should we have to support Deadwood here? And we could do that if they were wage slaves. Yeah, yeah. And furthermore, people like Count Tolstoy was well aware of the hardcore underneath the romantic arguments, and so were a number of other people. But the public dependent upon media and pulpits, which were subsidized by the owners, couldn't find a zone where they could think clearly, or someone would say, yeah, here's the truth, think about it.
Continuing later in this episode, I'll be playing a sample of a film titled Ma'afa 21 by Mark Crutcher. The Ma'afa is a Swahili term describing the period of African slavery in America. But as you'll soon hear, to learn the history of slavery is to learn the history of eugenics. The proponents of both are also participants in the undermining of our public education system. You see, as we've learned through the preceding episodes, it's essential to undermine public education in order for the managerial class, or the ranchers, to effectively manage the herd. The ranchers have figured out how to enslave individuals beyond the use of chains and cages, and they've planned and carried out a strategy of compulsory schooling to remove the individuality from individuals, thereby creating a herd mentality. Among the more famous of the historical palette of eugenicists are Plato, John Calvin, Francis Bacon, Baruch Spinoza, Thomas Malthus, Charles Darwin, and Francis Galton. and all of their students who believe that they are saved, using terms like the elect, to divide themselves from the masses, or as Francis Bacon refers to as the saved in his utopian epic, The New Atlantis, he calls them the society of the elect, who believe that the masses do not have free will, and that the masses are damned before they even arrive here on Earth. Since this concept is unlike anything in the public school education, let's go back to John Taylor Gatto in the interview, The Ultimate History Lesson, and let's hear what he has to say about the concept of justified sinning.
Now, if it were only those two major figures, but you now can go back a few hundred years in history to John Calvin's Institutes of the Christian Religion, which is this thick, tiny print. But if you ever go mad and actually force yourself to read it, rather than to read what an encyclopedia tells you it says, you'll find that Calvin says that the saved are saved before they're born. The damned, who are 19 to 1, are damned before they're born, and no amount of good work or behavior can save the damned, and no amount of evil behavior can damn the saved. The expression that used to be pretty common, but has vanished, I think on purpose, is justified sinners. The saved are justified sinners who can do anything. They can carpet bomb civilian populations, whether they're Nazis or Americans. You know, you've done no harm, according to Calvin. Calvin said the only way the elect, he called the saved, the elect will ever be safe, because they're outnumbered so heavily, is to set up a system of universal compulsion schooling with the intention of destroying the imagination and filling the head with garbage. Spinoza said the same thing. Fichte said the same thing.
If public schools are really about educating students and preparing them for the real world, then those schools should teach us about the fact that these people exist, and that they have a philosophy which allows them to prey on us, and that they consider themselves justified sinners, who have every right to take away our rights, literally in every way imaginable. But specifically, they seek to control the very DNA that makes up our bodies, and they've already patented the genetic codes of almost all of our main foods, having also corrupted them and patented their new versions and seeding the planet with these artificial plants. So this is a deep topic, which this episode is structured just to introduce you to these concepts for your further investigation. I might add that the way this course of consciousness that is Peace Revolution is structured is that I present the information that is publicly available, editing samples together and giving illustrations so as to provide a bigger picture than is otherwise publicly available. I then provide you with the links, the references, and the notes for further study. These episodes are points of introduction to get you started in thinking about these concepts, as it's in understanding these problems wherein the solutions become known. And in order to expedite that process, I'll also be calling upon Dr. Webster Tarpley later in this episode to assist in wrapping up, as the concept of eugenics does not just apply in the past or to feeble-minded people. And to do this, Tarpley brings a ton of references to bear throughout his interview, telling you exactly how real this is, who is currently involved, what their motivations are, and how to learn our way forward to make the concept of eugenics obsolete. There's also a link to the video version of this interview in the episode notes at peacerevolution.org. And I'll note that during the audio version of this video interview, there's a few video format artifacts remaining. So if you hear some little beeps in the background intermittently, those are just sound effects of the video production noting on screen the various pages of the books Tarpley's referring to. There's only a few, and it's something I couldn't remove. Last but not least, throughout history, the concept of utopia has influenced many people, including those who are currently the eugenicists and manipulators of our education system and everything else. So it's worth noting that it is the concept of utopia that allows the concept of justified sinning to emerge. And whether it's Plato's Utopia of Atlantis or Francis Bacon's The New Atlantis, these age-old ideas are adversely affecting us today and will continue to do so until we learn to better observe, recognize, and understand these problems. And this is a step in the right direction. And to that end, we continue our journey through this episode, starting with a 10-minute summary by James Corbett titled The Last Word on Utopia. This is episode 37, Justified Sinners, The History of Eugenics in America. Thank you for your support, and thank you for tuning in and not dropping out.
Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com with The Last Word on Utopia. Those with evil intent are seldom courteous enough to announce their intentions openly. As history has shown us time and again, oppressive tyrants seldom come to power campaigning on oppression. Quite the contrary. The most pernicious evil always presents itself as something necessary, something transitory, a mere waypoint on the road to the land of milk and honey. In this way, the masses can be led to not only tolerate the most intolerable conditions, but actually to support those who would seek to rule over them. In the early days, even the most ruthless dictators are wildly popular. By the time the public realizes it's been had and the blood starts flowing in the streets, it's too late. The regime is in place, and the promises that the tyrant used to gain power are already replaced with the yoke of repression. In France, the revolutionaries rallied under the banner of liberty, equality, and fraternity. Within a few short years, their revolution had morphed into the Reign of Terror, a bloody dictatorship of the guillotine in the name of securing the utopia that the public had been promised. Even at the height of the campaign, as the blood of the people flowed in the streets, Robespierre argued that the bloodshed was a virtuous outgrowth of democracy, and even wrote that it represented the despotism of liberty against tyranny. In Russia, the Bolsheviks came to power under the slogan Land, Peace, and Bread. Within just 5 years, however, Lenin had ensured a smooth transition from Tsarist dictatorship to Soviet dictatorship. He dissolved the Constituent Assembly, which the Bolsheviks did not control, after its first meeting. He disbanded the factory committees, which promised to give industrial workers democratic control over their own operations. And he vastly expanded the state security services, which imprisoned tens of thousands of anti-Bolsheviks and summarily executed thousands more. In Cambodia, the communist movement grew in strength and size on the back of the promise to restart civilization and return to Year Zero, a mythical paradise in which agrarian peasants would become rulers of their own destiny. On his rise to power, Saloth Sar, the leader of the Communist Party, stopped living with and consulting with the party leadership. Once he had attained control of the country, he changed his name to Pol Pot and began an extermination of 2 million of his own people, a full quarter of the country's population. One out of every four people in Cambodia died in Pol Pot's delusional pursuit of his imagined utopia. Nor are these by any means the only examples of this phenomenon. The English roundheads overthrew the king just to find that they had replaced him with a Lord Protector of aristocratic pretensions. Mussolini marched on Rome on the back of mass public support and proceeded to set up a prototypical fascist dictatorship. The Chinese were promised a great leap forward and ended up bathing in the blood of 60 million of their countrymen. Time after time, the masses have been whipped into a revolutionary fervor by leaders promising a perfect system of governance. And time after time, they have paid for that fervor with their lives. The term utopia itself was coined by Sir Thomas More in a tract written in the early 1500s. The name contains a play on words between the Greek term for nowhere, ou, and the prefix eu, meaning good. Utopia, then, is both an imaginary world, a nowhere land, and a good place, an ideal that we can strive toward in thinking of a good or just system of rule. More's utopia was distinctly socialist in nature. There is no money or private property. The economy and the workday are centrally planned to benefit the state. The community eats together in a common dining hall. Children are separated from their parents to be raised by nurses. In many ways, this depiction of a perfectly harmonious, perfectly regimented society laid the foundation for the last 500 years of utopian socialism. Time and again, utopian revolutionaries have returned to these ideas, whether from a misguided attempt to create an ideal society, or a cynical understanding that the utopian urge can be commandeered by an unscrupulous dictator for his own advantage. In the end, the results are always the same. The promised workers' paradise never seems to come, and the few at the top reap all the benefits. In modern times, a technological idealism has been grafted onto this utopian socialism to create an even more enticing strain of thought with which to capture the imagination of the masses. As the mechanization of the industrial era increased productivity beyond what could ever have been dreamed in the pre-industrial era, a group of technocrats emerged, promising a world in which technology itself would make possible a world of plenty. In this technological utopia, the machines would do the work, and the workers would be freed from the mundane jobs that had always defined their existence. The Bolsheviks especially latched onto the promise of technology in the early days of the Soviet Union. Aware of the enormous task before them, the Soviets hoped to create a modern, industrial, centrally planned economy out of the poor, feudal, agricultural Russian state they had taken over. The centerpiece of this technological transformation of Russia was to be Magnitogorsk, a steel manufacturing city in the Urals that was mandated into existence by Stalin's first five-year plan of 1929. The city was to be built from scratch and serve as an example of a technological utopia. The public was shown propaganda films depicting a modern paradise, a testament to the wonders of industry and the technocratic method. The reality, of course, turned out to be exactly the opposite of what the public had been promised. Today, Magnitogorsk is as dilapidated as the American industrial cities it was based on. The city is dirty and run down, residential areas are awash in the nauseous fumes of the factories that were supposed to be the marvels of this modern age. The residents, far from delighting in a world of plenty, long suffered under the yoke of Soviet repression and struggled to get their daily needs fulfilled. Ironically, Magnitogorsk did serve as the showcase of the Soviets' promised technological utopia. Unfortunately for the technocrats, what it showed was not how the machinery of the modern age would magically free those who had never been free, but how the very system of technological planning was fundamentally flawed, unable to provide even for the most basic needs of the citizenry. Remarkably, even now, long after the 20th century technocrats and their vision of the industrial nirvana have been so thoroughly discredited, after hundreds of years of utopian socialist fantasies have shown to lead to nothing but suffering and bloodshed, there is a new class of technocrats who are rising up to once again offer the masses a technological utopia which will provide for all their needs. Once again, we are being told that in this coming utopia, an army of benevolent machines will provide for all our needs. There will be no need for money or property, no need for violence or coercion of any kind ever again. In fact, we are told, this technological revolution will not only transform our society, but human nature itself. Freed from the shackles of want by the machines that will provide for all our needs, humans will no longer be violent or selfish or greedy. This system, we are told, will be rational and logical. The machines will know what resources are needed, how to acquire them, and how to distribute them. The machines will be able to calculate our needs and provide for them better than we ever could. The machines will be programmed by scientists, and, we are led to believe, they will always know how many toothbrushes to make. There is no need to worry about who owns the machines, we are told. No cause for concern about how they are programmed or how they make calculations about things we don't know. In this utopia, the proponents of this movement tell us there will be no evil people, no elite class that tries to control others, no one at all who tries to control the system, because human nature itself will no longer allow for it. Ultimately, perhaps it is not surprising that such utopian fantasies can still attract acolytes. The masses have always wanted the quick fix, the wave of the magic wand that will free them from this world of work, toil, and strife forever. How appealing it is to be offered the promise of a perfect system, a way to organize our society that will allow us to live in peace and harmony forever. After all, if such a system were really possible, who wouldn't want to attain it? But that, then, is the danger of the utopian ideal. The fact that it is always just out of reach, always just one step further down the path of good intentions, means that those who are willing to use this utopian fantasy to lead society in a dictatorial direction can dangle it before the public like a carrot to lead them down the garden path. It is, in short, nothing but a tool to enslave the public in the name of creating the perfect society. Indeed, not just to enslave them, but to get them to work toward their own enslavement. Until this is realized, utopia will always be a powerful motivating force for shaping our society. Those who promise a world of plenty, where we will receive everything for nothing, will always be popular with the public, looking for an easy solution to all their problems. And those who warn about the dangers of utopian thinking will never be popular. They will always be cast as obstacles in the path of the ideal society and dismissed as charlatans by the masses who are swept into revolutionary fervor, their judgment clouded by the comforting fog of utopian visions. No, it is never a popular thing to warn against utopia, but it is nonetheless necessary. For the Corbett Report in Western Japan, I am James Corbett.
Hidden among the ranches and rolling hills in the northern part of Denton County, Texas, the remains of more than 400 people lie in an overgrown cemetery. And even though it was abandoned and forgotten a long time ago, a few headstones can still be found. But most of the graves in this place never had a marker to begin with. That's because the people who were buried in them were considered to be property, not much different than a horse or a mule. This is where slaves were buried. Hello, my name is Marcus Lloyd.
And I'm Michelle Renee. We thank you for joining us. If you are African American, you and I will always be connected to the people whose bodies lie in that cemetery. Our ancestors may have worked alongside of them in the same cotton fields. They could have been bought and sold at the same auction houses or had chains hammered around their necks by the same overseer. Some of them may have even been hunted down by the same slave catcher or whipped by the same master.
For almost 250 years, our people were held in bondage. And today, this period of history has come to be known by an ancient Swahili word. It's called the Maafa. And it began when the first Africans were shackled to the bottom of a slave ship. But the irony is that it did not end when the slaves were freed. In fact, it hasn't ended yet. And as you're about to see, a hidden racial agenda is keeping the Maafa alive into the 21st century.
What shall be done with the 4 million slaves if they are emancipated? This question has been answered and can be answered in many ways. Primarily, it is a question less for man than for God, less for human intellect than for the laws of nature to solve. Our answer is, do nothing with them. Mind your business and let them mind theirs. Your doing with them is their greatest misfortune. They have been undone by your doings, and all they now ask and really have need of at your hands is just to let them alone. Frederick Douglass, 1862.
It is the stupidity of man to think that he can do evil, even some monstrous evil, and it won't have any backlash on himself. But of course, it seldom works that way. And the moment he figures that out, he starts looking for a way to avoid the repercussions of what he's done. This is what happened with slavery. In the early 1800s, as it began to look like the end of slavery might be on the horizon, white America started to be concerned that a day of reckoning was coming. The primary fear for the average person was of retribution and insurrection, and that was a reasonable fear. After all, it's illogical to think that you can do to a whole group of people what was done to African Americans and think that they will just take it lying down forever. And of course, there were things like the Nat Turner uprisings. But for the wealthy elite, their fears went beyond things like insurrection. They were worried about the financial impact. Remember, it was not just the cotton plantations that profited from slavery. Whether you're talking about the banks, or the insurance companies, the railroads, even the newspapers, the fact is that almost every aspect of the American economy was at some level or another invested in the slave business. You also need to recognize that for the wealthy elitist who controlled this system, slaves were an asset as long as they were slaves. But at the moment they are set free, they become a liability. And what the elite knew was that the end of slavery would instantly release 4 million people into the economy who had been kept uneducated and effectively unemployable anywhere but the cotton field. And what they were concerned about was that this was going to bankrupt the American economy. Taxes were going to go through the roof to take care of these people. Crime was going to be rampant. The prisons were going to be flooded. There was going to be this population overrun. And in the north, the biggest fear was migration from the south of these black people. The other fear that these people had was intermarriage between blacks and whites would lead to a loss of racial purity. The question was, what were they going to do about it? And their initial thought was that they would just send all the slaves back to Africa. This plan was called colonization, and it had broad support among the wealthy elite. In fact, the American Colonization Society was even funded by the United States Congress. But in the end, colonization proved to be unworkable, and the idea was eventually scrapped. But about that same time, a new philosophy was emerging in the world. It was called eugenics, and for some, it seemed like the perfect solution to what had become known as the Negro Dilemma.
I do not join in the belief that the African is our equal in brain or in heart. And I believe that if we can, in any fair way, possess ourselves of his services, we have an equal right to utilize them to our advantage. Francis Galton, 1857.
Francis Galton is known as the father of eugenics. He actually coined the phrase eugenics. So he believed in trying to increase those he felt were superior in stock and decrease those he felt were inferior. Francis Galton came from a very wealthy family, a family that made its wealth from the slave trade. And what a lot of people don't know is that Francis Galton was a cousin to Charles Darwin. Francis Galton took Charles Darwin's philosophies and ideas and thoughts, and he actually put them into practice, and that's what we know today as eugenics. Eugenics and evolution are related in that they both see what they consider to be the highest form of primate, such as the gorilla, as almost indistinguishable from what they consider the lowest form of human, the African and the Aborigine.
At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. The break between man and his nearest allies will then be wider, for it will intervene between man in a more civilized state, and some ape as low as a baboon instead of as now between the Negro or Australian and the gorilla. Charles Darwin, 1890.
Charles Darwin is very well known for writing The Origin of Species in the 1800s. This book gave rise to evolutionary theory. What people don't know is that there was actually a longer original title to this book, and that was On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Now, copies and editions that they made afterwards eliminated that phrase about the favored races. Evidently, they understood then that it was politically incorrect.
Some may defend Francis Galton because eventually that he rejected slavery, but they do point out that all of his wealth did derive from the slave trade, but also it needs to be known that he, as well as other eugenists, did not reject slavery until after it had ended. And they could not any longer exploit blacks legally. So at that point, it would have been quite easy for he and his cohorts to reject slavery. I think this is a point that we all have to really realize, that the eugenics movement was not invented by the everyday average white American, but by a select group of wealthy white elitists that had often used this ideology to pit all of white America against black America. And so we see that indeed that truly is the case even to this day.
Average Negroes possess too little intellect, self-reliance, and self-control to make it possible for them to sustain the burden of any respectable form of civilization without a large measure of external guidance and support. Francis Galton, 1873.
Eugenicists believed that Africans were inferior not just mentally but physically, and that left to themselves, left alone, they would not make it. The problem is, Didn't work. With that failure, the eugenicists moved on to what is known as positive eugenics. In positive eugenics, the eugenicists wanted the white population to reproduce, to have so many children that it overwhelmed the black population. But that didn't work either. Next, they moved on to what they called negative eugenics. They knew that they could not round up all the blacks in the nation and execute them, so they decided to create an environment where they would convince the blacks to severely limit the number of children they were going to have, and thereby commit race suicide.
The problem of the socially fit must be treated not as one of color, but as a problem of the spread of feeble-mindedness. Dr. Charles Davenport, 1913, director of the Eugenics Record Office, Cold Spring Harbor, New York, and co-founder of the American Eugenics Society.
The eugenics realized that they could not promote their agenda simply because they knew it would be viewed as politically incorrect and socially unacceptable. So what they did was use code words that were once successful in slavery, terms such as feeble-minded, unfit, words such as imbecile, immoral, criminal. They tagged those labels upon the targeted community. These words were less inflammatory, so it let society more or less not be totally alarmed of the original intent. But deep down inside, I believe everyone truly knew what segment of society and what people they were actually talking about.
Even a cursory glance at the charts, photographs, and diagrams used to popularize eugenic ideals reveals that the unfit were swarthy, black, and ugly by Anglo-Saxon standards, with flattened noses, wiry hair, and prognathous profiles. Harriet Washington, author, Medical Apartheid.
In the early 20th century, the white elitists who made up the eugenics movement were no longer just philosophers and academics. Now they were industrialists and billionaires who had come to embrace a worldview that was essentially identical to the eugenics movement. The same individuals and corporations who had once made millions on the backs of slaves were now willing to spend millions to get rid of them. But that didn't mean that these guys were interested in being public crusaders for the eugenics movement. They were certainly willing to be the brains and the money behind it, but they would hire crusaders to do the dirty work. And the primary one they settled upon was a woman named Margaret Sanger. She was the founder of the American Birth Control League and the publisher of its newsletter, The Birth Control Review. On a practical level, the relationship between Sanger and these elitists was basically a marriage of convenience. In order to advance their common agendas, they needed a front man and she needed money. And the whole thing would be held together by this kind of bizarre obsession with race and class. The result was that the American Birth Control League became the driving force behind the American eugenics movement. Eugenics would no longer just be a philosophy. Sanger and others like her were going to put it into practice.
We are paying for and even submitting to the dictates of an ever-increasing, unceasingly spawning class of human beings who never should have been born at all. Margaret Sanger, 1922.
The laws of nature require the obliteration of the unfit, and human life is valuable only when it is of use to the community or race. Madison Grant, 1916, co-founder, American Eugenics Society.
The black man has never been a competitor, but has always been subservient to the white race. And just so long as he remains subservient, his position is secure. And just so soon as he becomes a competitor, his fate is sealed. Dr. Benjamin Hayes, eugenicist, 1905.
The American Birth Control League was wise enough to get their program of population control across by using what had worked in the past, the same code words that had established the institution of slavery and that was also used by the early eugenics movement, was once again used by the American Birth Control League. The Margaret Sangers of those days did not come out and say they were trying to eliminate black people. What they did say, they were trying to rid society of the feeble-minded. They were trying to rid the society of the criminal. Well, she was successful simply because of her eugenics friends for the past 50 years had put those labels on minorities and African Americans, and therefore society was more or less desensitized. In effect, the code words hid the agenda of Margaret Sanger and the eugenist. At that time, they did shift over to what they called the quality of life. It was a philosophy unquestionably used to target the poor simply because what the quality of life at its core meaning was that poor people really didn't have a reason to live. Only the white, those with status, had any chance of a meaningful or purposeful life. The solution for the poor now was not to eliminate the circumstances that would cause poverty. Their solution now was to eliminate the poor, eliminate the impoverished, and just wipe them off the face of the earth.
The practice of birth control among the majority of colored people would probably be more eugenic than among their white compatriots. The dissemination of the information of birth control should have begun with this class, rather than with the upper social and economic classes of white citizens. Walter Turpinning, Birth Control Review, 1932.
In virtually every community where Negroes dwell, one finds them in Fat Times and Lean alike, contributing a disproportionate number to the roles of the dependents and delinquents. They make excessive demands on the white man's charity and overtax his patience. Newell Sims, Birth Control Review, 1932.
Author Madison Grant was a co-founder of the American Eugenics Society and an officer of the New York Zoological Society. In 1906, he had authorized an exhibit at the Bronx Zoo in which a 22-year-old African named Oda Benga was displayed in a cage in the monkey house. Sharing the cage with Benga was an orangutan.
When a local clergyman protested the exhibit, he said that it was clearly intended to be a demonstration of Darwin's theory of evolution. Local proponents of Darwinism apparently agreed and labeled the display educational. 10 years after this event, Oda Benga committed suicide.
During Hitler's regime, the Germans were supplied with elaborate charts and complicated theses supposedly proving the superiority of the German people. It is interesting to note that at the bottom of these charts were the colored people of the world, most conspicuously, the black people.
Floyd McKissick, National Director, Congress of Racial Equality, 1967.
An often overlooked fact about the German Holocaust is that the Nazis did not simply target the Jewish population. They went after the black community as well. Under the threat of being sent to concentration camps if they did not cooperate, Afro-German citizens were not only forced to undergo sterilization themselves, they were also required to turn over their children for sterilization. In his book Mein Kampf, Adolf Hitler explained the motivation behind such programs.
The Jews were responsible for bringing Negroes into the Rhineland. It suits the purpose of the cool, calculating Jew who would use this means of introducing a process of bastardization in the very center of the European continent, and, by infecting the white race with the blood of an inferior stock, would destroy the foundations of its independent existence. Adolf Hitler, Mein Kampf.
The Nazi attitude toward blacks was clearly defined in a 1944 book by Robert Ley, who was the head of the German Labor Front. Ley characterized the Jewish race as a disease-riddled parasite that had been created by unnatural inbreeding between white men and the racially inferior Negro. He described the result as a racial swamp that would eventually destroy the natural superiority of the Aryan race. Another Nazi publication described blacks as African brutes who had not been tamed even by centuries of slavery. It went on to say that any effort to assimilate people of African descent into civilized society was a waste of time, and that the lynchings of blacks in America did not merit any regret.
Since World War II, it has been well documented that Adolf Hitler was profoundly influenced by the American eugenics movement, and that many of his government's racial policies were actually developed from the writings of American eugenicists, like Madison Grant and Harry Laughlin. In fact, Hitler referred to Grant's book, The Passing of the Great Race, as his Bible.
Meanwhile, American eugenicists were routinely praising Hitler and holding up the Nazi eugenics program as a model for the United States to copy.
The leader of the German nation, Adolf Hitler, has been able to construct a comprehensive racial policy of population development and improvement. The difference between the Jew and the Aryan is as unsurmountable as that between black and white. Germany has set a pattern which other nations must follow. Dr. Clarence Gordon Campbell, 1935, President, Eugenics Research Association, New York.
Among those American eugenicists who most strongly supported the Nazis was a member of the American Eugenics Society, a director of the American Birth Control League, and a writer for the Birth Control Review. His name was Lothrop Stoddard.
As an avowed racist, Stoddard was the author of a book called The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, which was widely promoted by the Ku Klux Klan. In another book, The Dragon and the Cross, Stoddard was identified as the exalted Cyclops of the Massachusetts chapter of the Klan.
Non-white races must be excluded from America. The red and black races, if left to themselves, revert to a savage or semi-savage state in a short time. Lothrop Stoddard, Director, American Birth Control League.
On the 19th of December, 1939, during a four-month stay in Germany, Stoddard was given a personal meeting with both Adolf Hitler and the man who would eventually be in charge of the Nazi Holocaust, SS leader Heinrich Himmler.
Later, when a course on race was introduced at Halle University in Germany, its instructor stated that it would be modeled on the philosophies of American eugenicists, including Lothrop Stoddard. Eventually, Stoddard's racial views would even be featured in Nazi school textbooks.
The white race divides into three main subspecies: the Nordics, the Alpines, and the Mediterraneans. All three are good stocks, ranking in genetic worth well above the various colored races. Lothrop Stoddard, Director, American Birth Control League.
To eliminate blacks from Germany, one of the people Hitler called on was a eugenicist who had once written that blacks are an inferior race of savages who should only be allowed to survive as long as they are of use to the Aryan race. His name was Eugen Fischer. And about 20 years earlier, he had been one of the leaders of a system of concentration camps in southwestern Africa, where blacks were rounded up to be executed, experimented on, or held as free labor. Under Hitler, Fischer would serve on committees that planned the sterilization of all blacks in countries that came under German control. He would also be one of the first Nazi scientists to become publicly affiliated with the Carnegie-funded eugenics laboratory in Cold Spring Harbor, New York. Eventually, Fischer would also be put in charge of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, which was funded by the Rockefeller Foundation. It was here that many of the Nazi programs for creating racial purity were developed.
In 1927, Margaret Sanger organized the World Population Conference in Geneva, Switzerland, and gave it front-page coverage in her Birth Control Review. The event's program shows that several of its attendees were colleagues of Sanger's from the American eugenics movement. It also documents that among those who were given a leadership role in the conference was Eugen Fischer, the man who would eventually lead the Nazi effort to eradicate blacks from Europe.
Another American eugenicist with Nazi connections was Harry Laughlin. He was an official with both the American Eugenics Society and the American Birth Control League, and in 1928, his plan for using forced sterilization to eliminate those who might produce what he called degenerate offspring was published in the Birth Control Review. In 1936, Laughlin led an effort to distribute the English language version of a Nazi eugenics film to audiences in the northeastern part of the United States. He had acquired the rights to the film from the Race Policy Office of the Nazi Party, and with the help of two other American eugenics organizations, had mailed literature to biology teachers at 3,000 U.S. high schools, urging them to show it in their classrooms. Later that year, Laughlin was praised in a Nazi newspaper and awarded an honorary degree from the University of Heidelberg for his contributions to the Nazi eugenics effort.
In the 1930s, a German psychiatrist named Ernst Rudin was named president of the International Federation of Eugenics in Cold Spring Harbor, New York, which was funded by the Carnegie Corporation. And in 1933, his call for racial purity was published in the Birth Control Review.
Later, Rudin would be chosen by Hitler to write Germany's eugenics laws. And at one point, he personally helped the Gestapo round up and sterilize several hundred blacks, who they referred to as Rhineland bastards. After the war, Rudin would be identified as one of the architects of the barbaric medical experiments that the Nazis carried out in their concentration camps.
It may be possible that Hitler actually got the idea for concentration camps while studying the American eugenics movement. In 1919, the state of Indiana had allocated $300,000 to create a work colony in the city of Butlerville, where those who were labeled feeble-minded would be incarcerated. Then in 1932, Margaret Sanger called for the United States government to set aside farms and open spaces where certain groups of people would be segregated from the rest of society. She proposed that, among others, the illiterate, the unemployed, and the poor should be forcibly kept in these areas until they developed what she called better moral conduct.
It was later discovered that under the Indiana program, the state was allowed to label someone feeble-minded if they were poor or did not do well in school, or if the state considered them to be shiftless or have insufficient moral judgment. But it's important to understand that this Indiana campaign was not unlike those in other states. For example, a eugenics project conducted in Massachusetts during the late 1920s proposed sterilization for young girls who were diagnosed as defective, which could include being unwed and pregnant, financially poor, or if the state labeled them socially undesirable. In addition, boys as young as 14 could be castrated for showing signs of kleptomania or for exhibiting what was described as solitary behavior.
In a single incident during 1935, the Nazis sterilized the children of over 600 German women because it was reported that those children had been fathered by black men.
When news of this reached the United States, a member of the American Eugenics Society named Walter Ashby Plecker wrote a letter to the German Bureau of Human Betterment and Eugenics, praising them for the action and expressing his hope that not one child had been missed. 10 years earlier, Plecker had written that the black population was the greatest problem and most destructive force which confronts the white race and American civilization.
Eugenics goals are most likely attained under a name other than eugenics. Frederick Osborne, president and founding member of the American Eugenics Society.
By the late 1930s and early 1940s, revelations about Nazi and fascist atrocities in Europe were causing the public to become increasingly uncomfortable with terms like eugenics and population control. This alarmed the leaders of the American Birth Control League, who were aware that this shifting attitude could impact both their ability to implement their racial agenda and their ability to raise funds. They were also aware that the connections between the American Birth Control League and the Nazis were starting to become known. Marketing research had shown them that in this environment, they needed to move away from words like control in favor of less threatening words like planning. So in 1942, they changed the name of the organization. From then on, the American Birth Control League would officially be known as Planned Parenthood.
The important thing to understand here is that this name change did not change the organization's agenda. The same people were still in control, they were still obsessed with race, and they were still dedicated to eugenics. Today, defenders of Margaret Sanger will often try to hide her racism by claiming that she was not really a eugenicist, and that Planned Parenthood was never part of the eugenics movement. But the truth is that as late as 1956, the American Eugenics Society listed Sanger as a member of the organization. In addition, many of Sanger's colleagues and the people whose writings she published, as well as many of Planned Parenthood's officers, were also known to be members.
In fact, the ties between Sanger and the eugenics movement were so well established that in the 1920s, Sanger pursued a plan to merge the American Birth Control League, or Planned Parenthood, as it was later called, with the American Eugenics Society. However, despite Sanger's efforts, the merger plan died after being rejected by the leadership of the American Eugenics Society. As an alternative, Sanger then proposed that the two organizations at least combine their publications into one magazine. But again, that idea was also rejected by the American Eugenics Society.
The eugenic and civilization value of birth control is becoming apparent to the enlightened and the intelligent. The campaign for birth control is not merely of eugenic value, but is practically identical in ideal with the final aim of eugenics. Margaret Sanger, 1921.
In her autobiography, Margaret Sanger wrote about a speech she gave in 1926 at a Ku Klux Klan rally in Silver Lake, New Jersey. The Planned Parenthood founder bragged about the fact that afterward, she was invited by 12 other Klan chapters to speak at their events.
At about the same time the American Birth Control League was changing its name to Planned Parenthood, a lot of books and reports began coming out that attempted to put a happy face on eugenics. And many of them were written by people that were associated with Planned Parenthood. The strategy here was obvious. Since the Nazis had turned eugenics into a four-letter word, the American eugenics movement decided it was time to lay low. So most of their writings during this time period downplayed the role of eugenics and couched their agenda in terms of helping the African-American. Perhaps the best example of this is a 1,500-page book by eugenicist Gunnar Myrdal called An American Dilemma, The Negro Problem in Modern Democracy. Interestingly, this book was not the result of some mom-and-pop operation. Myrdal had 75 assistants working on this project whose salaries were being paid for by the Carnegie Corporation. And Carnegie had been a major player in the eugenics movement for many years.
Gunnar Myrdal and his wife Alva were both involved in eugenics. They were funded by both the Rockefeller Foundation and the Carnegie Corporation. They were also closely linked to a Swedish eugenics program which forcibly sterilized 66,000 people. When you read chapter 7 of this book, it becomes undeniable that this is a blueprint for the modern eugenics movement that we still see in the United States today. The bottom line is that Gunnar Myrdal believed that not only could blacks not help themselves, he felt that nobody could help them, and the only solution in his eyes was to get rid of them.
Commonly, it is considered a great misfortune for America that Negro slaves were ever imported. The presence of Negroes in America today is usually considered a plight of the nation. Chapter 7, page 167. All white Americans agree that if the Negro is to be eliminated, he must be eliminated slowly, so as not to hurt any living individual Negroes. Chapter 7, page 168. The only way possible of decreasing Negro population is by means of controlling fertility. Chapter 7, page 170. Birth control facilities could be extended relatively more to Negroes than to whites, since Negroes are more concentrated in the lower income and education classes. Chapter 7, page 176.
One thing I find very revealing about Chapter 7 is the first paragraph. Murdahl uses U.S. Census Bureau figures to show that between 1790 and 1940, the black population in the United States increased 17 times. At the same time, those Census Bureau figures show that the white population increased 37 times. However, neither Murdahl nor any other eugenicist wrote anything about what to do about that part of the population that was increasing twice as fast as the black population.
Gunnar Myrdal's book on how to resolve what he called the Negro problem was published in 1944 by Harper and Brothers of New York. 4 years earlier, the same company, which is today known as HarperCollins, had also published a book by one of the founding members of the American Eugenics Society. At the time that Harper and Brothers published these books, its president was a man named Cass Canfield, who would later become the national president of Planned Parenthood.
We hope that the restraint of population growth can come about through voluntary means. But if it does not, involuntary methods will be used. Dr. Donald Minkler, 1972.
Donald Minkler was the president of the American Association of Planned Parenthood Physicians and a member of the board of directors of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Like many of those in the eugenics movement, he understood that their plans would not always be voluntarily adopted, and that the use of governmental coercion or even force might one day be necessary.
The idea of forced eugenics was not something that suddenly developed in the 1970s. In a 1929 speech, American eugenicist Samuel Holmes had proposed that mandatory birth control should be used as a tool to eliminate what he called the menace to the white race that had been created by increases in black population. His solution was to have a quota system in which the right to have a child would be controlled by the government and determined by race. At the time, Holmes was on the National Council of the American Birth Control League, which would later become known as Planned Parenthood.
Then, in 1936, eugenicist Julian Huxley proposed that the genetically inferior classes could be made to have fewer children if they were denied easy access to welfare. Another part of this proposal was that medical care to these same people should be restricted in order to reduce the survival rates of the children they did have. He also called for the forced sterilization of anyone who was unemployed beyond a certain length of time. Huxley was later honored by Planned Parenthood and was a featured speaker at one of their annual conventions.
The reality is that the views of people like Samuel Holmes and Julian Huxley were never uncommon within the American eugenics community. In 1969, a professor at the University of California, Dr. Garrett Hardin, called it insanity to rely on voluntarism to control population. Hardin was a member of the American Eugenics Society and an outspoken advocate of government-enforced birth control, saying that citizens should be willing to give up their right to breed for the betterment of society. In 1980, he was given Planned Parenthood's highest national award. He and his wife would later kill themselves in a joint suicide pact.
There were, of course, some within the eugenics movement who were uncomfortable with the idea of using force, and they would often express their reservations about it in public. But when pressed, virtually none of them would rule it out, including Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger.
I consider that the world and almost our civilization for the next 25 years is going to depend upon a simple, cheap, safe contraceptive to be used in poverty-stricken slums, jungles, and among the most ignorant people. Even this will not be sufficient because I believe that now, immediately, there should be national sterilization for certain dysgenic types of our population who are being encouraged to breed and would die out were the government not feeding them. Margaret Sanger, 1950.
This was written by Sanger in a personal letter to Catherine Dexter McCormick. McCormick was an heir to the International Harvester fortune and would later use part of her immense wealth to fund the development of the birth control pill.
In 1966, an example of the coercive power of state eugenics laws was seen in Maryland when three young mothers applied for welfare benefits. All three were arrested for child neglect, even though the authorities never claimed to have any evidence of abuse or neglect. Instead, the women were held under a state law which stated that simply being unmarried and pregnant was child neglect. The judge in this case warned the women that if they ever became pregnant again, the state would take custody of all their children. Officials in Prince George's County, where the arrest took place, stated that welfare recipients could avoid being prosecuted under this law by submitting to state-sponsored birth control education.
In 1934, Adolf Hitler sent a letter to American eugenicist Leon Whitney, complimenting him for a book he had written on sterilization. Whitney was the former executive secretary of the American Eugenics Society and a colleague of Margaret Sanger's. Sanger also published his writings in the Birth Control Review.
In the book that Hitler was praising, Whitney had written that America could eliminate what he called the slum elements of society by sterilizing the lowest 25% of its population. He claimed this was necessary because such people are too stupid to understand or practice even simple methods of contraception. Besides, he said, the country would hardly miss them. One of the people he was talking about was named Elaine Riddick.
At the age of 13, I became pregnant. I was raped by a guy that lived across the street from me. He snatched me off the street and molested me and threatened my life and said if I ever told anyone that he would kill me. When they was delivering my son, they sterilized me at the same time. They had approached my grandmother and said that if she wanted to continue to receive supplement, welfare and food stamps, or at this time it was giving out these surplus foods. Canned cheese, I think it was, or powdered eggs, and said that if she did not sign the X, that they were going to stop her supplements. Mind you, my grandmother was illiterate. She had never, ever gone to school. She didn't understand what it was. So she signed the X, and they did this to me. I did not find out that they had sterilized me until I was 19 years old. I asked the state of North Carolina why they did this to me, and they said that because I was feeble-minded, that I would not be able to take care of myself, I would not be able to tie my shoes, that I was just incompetent. The state of North Carolina also said that I had never performed, at the age of 13, I had never performed a day's work in my life. They couldn't get me to do anything. But at the age of 13, I mean, should I not have been in school? They were saying that feeble-mindedness is hereditary. So they sterilized me so I would not produce my kind. Mind you, I am not illiterate, nor am I feeble-minded. I never went into high school, but yet I still acquired a college degree. They also justified that my child or my children would be feeble-minded. My son is the president of his own semiconductor company. He has his own construction company. And he has his own real estate company. How can you think that your government allowed or allowing these things to happen to a person, a life? You can't say nothing. You have no rights. To me, they took away all of my rights. They sterilized kids
from my understanding and my knowledge as young as 8 years of age. I don't know what an 8-year-old can do that could cause them to do this to them. The only reason I can give myself is that because they're black.
In 1961, social worker Sue Casebolt had been installed as the executive secretary of the North Carolina Eugenics Board. At a board meeting held 3 weeks later, she stated that she was going to keep a file on every child whose name reached her desk so that they could be picked up as soon as they reached childbearing age. Casebolt was still on the board in 1968 when it approved the sterilization of 14-year-old Elaine Riddick.
It is better for all the world if instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. 3 generations of imbeciles are enough. Oliver Wendell Holmes, U.S. Supreme Court Justice, 1927.
Holmes made this statement in his ruling on the constitutionality of Virginia's forced sterilization law. It mirrored the views of President Theodore Roosevelt, who had originally appointed Holmes to the Supreme Court. In a 1913 letter to American Eugenics Society founder Charles Davenport, Roosevelt had stated that the country had no business allowing citizens of the wrong type to reproduce.
In 1907, Indiana had become the first of more than 30 states to pass sterilization laws, and some of those laws stayed on the books well into the 1970s. In fact, the state of Oregon did its last sterilization in 1981 and did not abolish its eugenics board until October of 1983.
Some states practice sterilization without ever creating an official eugenics board. In those instances, few, if any, records were kept. And in the states that did keep records, many have never been made available to the public. But in just those states that have released their records, it is known that at least 60,000 Americans were sterilized, and they were disproportionately black. In addition, during a 1973 lawsuit, a federal judge estimated that as many as 150,000 additional low-income women may have been sterilized under federal programs alone. These sterilizations were often performed without the patient's knowledge or consent, and sometimes against their will. It was also common for social workers to tell welfare recipients that they would lose their benefits if they did not agree to be sterilized. In some cases, poor families were even threatened with the loss of welfare unless they brought their children in for sterilization. The result was that some of the people sterilized were as young as 10 years old.
In the first 6 months of 1972, one hospital in Aiken County, South Carolina, sterilized over one-third of the Medicaid patients who were there to give birth, and all but one of these women were black. One patient said she was told by all 3 of the county's obstetricians that they would not deliver her baby unless she agreed to be sterilized. Her claim was later confirmed by each of the doctors. Another patient said she was told by one of these same physicians that he was tired of having to help support the babies of welfare recipients and that she could either agree to be sterilized or find another doctor.
The law of nature says that only the fit shall survive. When a nation disregards this law by protecting the unfit and encouraging their multiplication, this nation invites inevitable destruction. As far as New Jersey is concerned, sterilization is an economic necessity. And as far as the United States is concerned, sterilization is a matter of national preservation. Fred Shepard, Assemblyman.
Fred Shepard was a member of the New Jersey State Legislature. He made this statement upon his introduction of a sterilization bill in March of 1942.
In some parts of the country, Planned Parenthood was closely associated with these state eugenics boards and was often a referral agency for them. But the system did not always run smoothly. In 1969, when the number of sterilizations approved by the Iowa State Eugenics Board began to drop, the board was attacked in the press by the executive director of Planned Parenthood, Robert Weber. He said that he was alarmed by the decline in numbers and that the eugenics board should expand its approval criteria. Board Chairman Dr. S.M. Corson responded that the board's guidelines were already fairly broad. He pointed out that approvals were routinely given for young girls for no reason other than the board's speculation that they might likely one day engage in immoral behavior without the capacity for being wives and mothers. At that point, Weber publicly scolded the board and told them that they should either increase the number of sterilizations or quit.
From its beginning, Planned Parenthood always had powerful ties to the American eugenics community. In fact, in many places, they were often one and the same. For example, when the first birth control clinic was opened in Arkansas, it was operated by the Arkansas Eugenics Association and overseen by a woman named Hilda Cornish. Later, the Arkansas Eugenics Association would become the Arkansas state affiliate of Planned Parenthood, and Cornish would be named its executive director.
During the 4 months that American Birth Control League director Lothrop Stoddard was in Nazi Germany, he not only met with Hitler and SS chief Heinrich Himmler, he also attended one of the Nazi eugenics courts.
The first case I saw looked like an excellent candidate for sterilization. A man in his mid-30s, he was rather ape-like in appearance. Receding forehead, flat nose with flaring nostrils, thick lips, and heavy prognathous jaw. Not vicious looking, but gross and rather dull. Lothrop Stoddard, director, American Birth Control League, later known as Planned Parenthood.
Given the admiration that Adolf Hitler expressed for the American eugenics movement, it is not unlikely that he modeled the eugenics courts in Nazi Germany after the state eugenics boards in the U.S. In both countries, feeble-mindedness was routinely used as a catch-all justification for sterilization, and the diagnosis of feeble-mindedness was almost always left up to the judgment of the person advocating the sterilization.
First the white man tells me to sit in the back of the bus. Now it looks like he wants me to sleep under the bed. Back in the days of slavery, black folks couldn't grow kids fast enough for white folks to harvest. Now that we got a little taste of power, white folks wants to call a moratorium on having babies. Comedian Dick Gregory, Ebony Magazine, 1971.
By the 1960s, the American eugenics movement had been reasonably successful in getting sterilization laws and prohibitions against interracial marriage passed. They also had some success in getting states to mandate sterilization for those convicted of even non-sexual crimes, and some states began to require sterilization as a condition for receiving welfare or health care. Meanwhile, another state proposed jail time for anyone who had a child out of wedlock unless they agreed to be sterilized, and at least one state requires sterilization as a condition of being released from custody.
But these laws were not producing the results Planned Parenthood and others in the eugenics movement wanted. They also began to fear that federal courts were going to eventually rule that these kinds of measures were unconstitutional. At about the same time, however, something new was being introduced to American society. It was called the birth control pill, and the eugenics movement quickly saw it as the perfect solution for controlling the population of people they had always seen as oversexed, unsophisticated, and lazy. But what they would eventually discover is that while the pill was enthusiastically embraced by whites, it was generally rejected by blacks, despite the fact that Planned Parenthood focused its marketing on the African American community and located the vast majority of its facilities in black neighborhoods.
What Planned Parenthood and the rest of the eugenics movement did not count on was that many blacks did not want to reduce their numbers. In fact, they saw high birth rates as the most effective way to increase their power in the American political system. The other reality was that an increasing number of African Americans were becoming suspicious that a hidden agenda was behind the birth control revolution. Even those who once supported the idea of population control were beginning to sense that it actually meant black population control.
This feeling was evident in June of 1970 when the Black Caucus walked out of the first National Congress on Optimum Population and Environment being held in Chicago. Felton Alexander of the National Urban League and the chairman of the Black Caucus said the action was taken because of clear and unmistakable evidence that the purpose of the conference was to legitimize the extermination of the black population. By this time, many other civil rights advocates were beginning to see the same thing.
Contraceptives will become a form of drug warfare against the helpless in this nation. Jesse Jackson, 1971.
There is a campaign to bombard the poor with pills and potions. If this movement continues, we soon may be accused of fighting poverty by eliminating the poor and overcoming hunger by removing the hungry. New York Congressman Hugh Carey, 1966.
Under the cover of an alleged campaign to alleviate poverty, white supremacist Americans and their dupes are pushing an all-out drive to put rigid birth control measures into every black home. No such drive exists within the white American world. Black Unity Party, 1968.
Birth control and sterilization in the wrong hands would be more deadly to Negroes than all the tanks, riot guns, cattle prods, billy clubs, and shackles we have overcome in the past.
Dr. Leroy Swift, obstetrician, gynecologist, 1968.
As it became clear that a growing number of African Americans were connecting the dots between birth control and black genocide, eugenics organizations began calling for the U.S. government to add birth control chemicals to the nation's food and water supply. It was even suggested that this strategy could be specifically targeted at urban neighborhoods. This idea was widely embraced in the eugenics movement and taken seriously enough by the government to be discussed at a 1969 meeting at the United Nations. Under the plan being considered, a couple could apply to the government for permission to have a child, and if approved, they would be given an antidote to the population control chemicals they had ingested in their food and water. Interestingly, the idea that government should have some sort of licensing agreement to regulate who would and would not be allowed to give birth was not a new one. In 1934, Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger had proposed that the U.S. government implement a system in which women would not have the legal right to have a child without a permit from the government, and that these permits would only be good for one baby.
But eventually, proposals like forced sterilization, chemicals in the food and water supply, and government control of childbearing were abandoned by most people in the eugenics movement. Despite the fact that many of them openly advocated such ideas, they would come to realize that there was really no practical way to carry them out. But for all their failures, what the eugenics movement had accomplished was to lay the foundation for the next phase of their plan. And this is where they would find the success that they had been chasing for over 100 years.
What would you say is now the number one cause of death in the African American community?
Heart disease.
Oh, HIV AIDS.
Diabetes. Cancer. AIDS.
I'll say heart disease.
AIDS.
From what I heard, it's probably AIDS, you know.
Probably heart disease.
I think heart disease.
HIV. Gang violence.
What if I told you the real answer was abortion?
Since 1973, legal abortion has killed more African Americans than AIDS, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and violent crime combined. Every week, more blacks die in American abortion clinics than were killed in the entire Vietnam War. And the largest chain of abortion clinics in the United States is operated by Planned Parenthood.
We have
have now reached a point in this country that African American women, though they make up 12% of the population, they account for 37% of the abortions. An African American baby is almost 5 times more likely to be aborted than a white child. The abortion industry at this point kills as many African American people every 4 days as the Klan killed in 150 years. And you can truly say the most dangerous place for an African American to be is in the womb of their African American mother.
All across America, you can stand outside of the abortion clinics and see a steady stream of black women coming in and out. But somewhere along the way, we got the idea that this is a white issue or a conservative issue or a Republican issue, and therefore, it's not an issue that we have to be concerned about. This same attitude has allowed Planned Parenthood and other members of the abortion industry to carry out this genocide right under our very noses. Right now, in America, about half of our babies are being killed in the womb. And in certain parts of America, more of our babies are being aborted than are being born.
When 17,000 aborted babies were found in a dumpster outside of a pathology laboratory in Los Angeles, California, some 12 to 15,000 were observed to be black. Irma Clardy Craven, Chairman, Minneapolis Commission on Human Rights and Secretary of the Urban League.
To understand what the agenda was behind the legalization of abortion, all you need to do is look at the statistics from the U.S. government. Studies from the CDC show that prior to the legalization of abortion, approximately 80% of all illegal abortions were done on white women. One study in New York even found that white women had 5 times as many abortions as black women. But at the moment abortion became legal, that began to reverse. And that's why the legalization of abortion was so crucial for the eugenics movement. Legalization created the ability to market abortion in the black community. And from a eugenics standpoint, that changed everything.
These people cannot have it both ways. First, they say that birth control will reduce the number of abortions. Then they flood our neighborhoods with birth control clinics. And what's the result? Our abortion rate skyrockets. So either they lied about the fact that birth control would reduce abortions in our neighborhoods, or this is the results and the purpose they wanted from the beginning. At this point, I truly have the tendency to believe the latter.
Today, I'm pleased to announce members of my science and technology team. Dr. John Holdren has agreed to serve as Assistant to the President for Science and Technology and Director of the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy.
John P. Holdren is the resident science czar of the Obama White House. He's the head of the White House Council on Science and Technology, key advisor operating out of the new Executive Office Building in Washington, D.C. This man is a Malthusian fanatic. He's a follower of Bentham and Malthus and Darwin. In other words, the main philosophers of the British Empire in the 19th century and the fountainhead of reactionary and anti-human ideology in that time frame. He's a radical environmentalist, an ecological fanatic, a green kook, a wacko, except that it's also very sinister because the implications of his belief structure and his world outlook are genocide. He is, in particular, an enemy of the traditional American point of view on the world. Holdren polemicizes in his books against people he calls the cornucopians, people who think that the bounty of nature and of production is unlimited. He says that's not true. There are limits to growth, and we have to live within those limits. He polemicizes against growthsmanship, that you can grow your way out of a crisis. According to Holdren, that door has been permanently closed on all of us. And in particular, He says he hates the moonshot mentality of the average American. And that is to say, with the right kind of national mobilization, technology, and political will, you can do just about anything, including putting a man on the moon and putting other people out into space. So Holdren is anti-American in this deep way. He is a pessimist culturally and historically. He calls himself a neo-Malthusianism. Now, the heart of his outlook is what he calls, he says that population is the root of all human problems. In other words, people pollute. Humanity is a cancer on the face of the earth. The one big problem in the ecosystem is the role of humankind. And of course, in reality, the existing ecosystem could not survive without the constant contributions of human production. It's very easy to show that. Holdren started off in the 1970s with Paul Ehrlich, who was a charlatan and an obscurantist and a crackpot, who wrote the book The Population Bomb. Ehrlich was convinced that world population was growing out of control and that this was going to lead to a breakdown of human civilization sometime in the late 20th century. And it goes together with the campaign of the Limits of Growth, the Club of Rome, Aurelio Piché, and the rest of these people. This is kind of the intellectual milieu that Holdren comes out of. Now, there was no population bomb. It's just not true. It never happened. Population in Europe is falling, if you just look at the self-renewal of these populations. Same thing in Japan, same thing in Russia. They've all got a demographic problem, which has nothing to do with overpopulation. It has to do with shrinking population. China has demographic problems that were caused by going along with this two-child-per-family policy. The U.S. would be experiencing demographic decline if it weren't for the flow of immigrants into the country. So there never was a population bomb, but Holdren does not revise or change his pseudoscientific outlook because of this. Population is the problem. Now, he looks around the world, writing in the early 1970s in one of his textbooks, and he says, some countries have so much population that they ought to be triaged. We should cut them off, give them no more food aid, no more credit, no more help of any kind. Well, what are the countries? He says India is probably on the list. India, hundreds and hundreds of millions of people, and Holdren says, cast them into the outer darkness. Then Bangladesh, with a couple of hundred million people, Holdren says, for sure, Bangladesh has got to be triaged. Give them nothing. Now again, the note of genocide. The idea that whole countries should be consigned to doom puts Holdren in a league which is far beyond Hitler in terms of the number of victims that these policies would result in. He hates science and technology. He wants to limit science and technology. He regards them as a threat to what he thinks of as the social order, and also to the crackpot views of charlatans and fakers like himself. He says he wants to create a science court that would decide which inventions could be put into practice and which would have to be banned. This is unbelievable. This would essentially strangle the source of human progress and consign us all into a stagnation and ruin, which would never end. Holdren believes that there's a world optimum population, or carrying capacity. Now, the idea of carrying capacity comes from the writings of a Venetian kook by the name of Gian Maria Ortes, O-R-T-E-S. Writing in 1790 or thereabouts, Ortes said that the limit of the world population was 3 billion people, and that if you went beyond that, you'd have famine and starvation and death, and it would always tend back to 3 billion people. Now, Holdren is even worse. He's more genocidal than Gian Maria Ortes. He's more genocidal than Malthus, who followed in the footsteps of Ortes. Holdren says that the optimum world population is 1 billion. Now, let's pause. At the time Holdren wrote that, the world population was already 4 billion. Today, if you say the optimum population is 1 billion, it would mean that more than 5 billion would have to go. And again, these are orders of magnitude that Hitler, Stalin, and Mao never dreamed of. Only in the mind of fanatics like Holdren do we get genocide of these proportions. Holdren says that the big task of policy, and here the third world and developing countries should take note, he says the main political problem facing the world is not world economic development, but stopping world economic development. He's very worried that countries like China and India and others, Latin America, South Asia, Sub-Saharan Africa, that they're going to try to imitate the development of the US, Europe, and Japan. And Holdren says that would be catastrophic. What we need is to stop third world development. We've got to convince the third world not to do that, and we've got to institute de-development worldwide. In other words, turn back the clock of history, roll back progress, and go back to what amounts to pre-industrial civilization. Well, pre-industrial civilization is a lifespan of 30 to 35 years, nasty, brutish, and short, as Hobbes put it. So that's what Holdren wants for you and your family. In order to enforce this, he talks about a supranational monstrosity that he calls a planetary regime. This means a world empire, a supranational, one-world government that would attempt to control all details of human life. Would start with what he calls the global commons. That is to say, anything that impacts the air, the soil, and the oceans would become the subject of international, supranational intervention. It would be like the IMF on steroids. Instead of just economic life, it would extend to everything. Again, the temperature in your living room, the kind of car you have, the amount you get to eat, whether you have a pet, I mean, minimal details about your everyday life. For individual countries such as the U.S., Holdren recommends a population law which would fix the outer limits of the acceptable population. And again, what happens if you are surplus? What happens if you are declared a useful leader? He doesn't say that so explicitly, but it's clear that you wouldn't fare very well. So one of the features of a population law, in Holdren's point of view, is to regulate the size of the family. And this is what, of course, China did in the post-Mao period, the two-child per family policy. So the hand of the totalitarian state intervenes in the most intimate decisions of the family, and the realm of individual responsibility pretty much ceases to exist. Now, Holdren is willing to do just about anything to, first of all, slow the rate of population increase. That's his first goal. Secondly, to bring population into stasis or equilibrium, zero growth, but then to turn it back and have a decreasing, diminishing world population. The Chinese experience is if you do that, you're flirting with economic collapse. But Holdren doesn't care about that. He's, of course, a fanatic. So what is he willing to do? He talks about all kinds of forced sterilization. That you can have surgical interventions on males. In India, he says, there was a policy of obligatory vasectomy once you had two children in the family if you were a government employee. He says that's something we could think about imitating. Compulsory abortion. Think about that. That would be something that was flirted with in post-Maoist China. He wants to have licenses for birth. In other words, a woman is not allowed to give birth unless she's purchased a marketable birth license. And of course, what happens if Goldman Sachs comes in and, because women are going to want those, drives up the price 100 times so that nobody can afford a birth permit? And what happens to people that are born illegitimately, meaning without a birth permit? He wants to have things that have been done in the meantime. Norplant, I think, is an example. Subcutaneous chemical devices that are put into the flesh of women to prevent them from conceiving. So forced sterilization, compulsory abortion, forced vasectomy, birth licenses, subcutaneous implants, all kinds of compulsory, obligatory methods. In terms of forced sterilizations, he says you could do this by putting chemicals in food and water, but he thinks that these other methods would be more effective. He also has other methods of persuasion, which are really coercion, that if you have more than two kids in the family, there's no more free public education for you. The third kid has to pay to go to the public school. If you're living in public housing, which is the case in some countries, the third kid gets you kicked out of the public housing and you become homeless. He's also in favor of violating the family by seizing babies. He says that if it's a teenager or a minor who has had an illegitimate child and there's no husband in the picture, then the government should come in and seize that child and have a policy of forced adoption to take care of that illegitimate child. You can see that Holdren is a collectivist. He is not a collectivist of the Marxist type, however. I would call him a collectivist in the tradition of Rousseau for two reasons. Remember, there are two Rousseaus. One is the Rousseau who says that the noble savage is the goal of human life. In other words, the more primitive you are, the less civilization you have, the better you are. Just if you think about that, Rousseau on that basis is one of the most influential philosophers of the current time, because it basically says primitive societies are better than corrupt modern society, so we should go back to nature and go back to the ways of these underdeveloped peoples. But then there's the other side of Rousseau, which is the collective will. The late Rousseau writes about the collective will in that the individual counts nothing compared to the collective will. This is essentially the philosophy of the reign of terror in the French Revolution, and that's pretty much where Holdren is. So I would call him a Rousseauvian fanatic in addition to being a Malthusian and a Darwinist and a Benthamite, and he wants to have the noble savage, roll back civilization, go back to pre-industrial civilization, or call it civilization if you want to, and at the same time he wants to impose the collective will. He even writes about infanticide. He says that infanticide is found in many primitive peoples, and he says, well, what that means is that these societies thought that the survival of the group and the collectivity was more important than the individual, so they didn't hesitate to kill babies, which implies Holdren's idea of civilization. It's a form of barbarity. Again, in Holdren's world, there are two main evils. One is overpopulation, the other is industrial pollution. In the world we live in, the main problem is poverty, ignorance, disease, backwardness, illiteracy, and the rest. The main problem of today's world is a massive underproduction of most of the worldly goods that humans need: food, clothing, shelter, transportation, jobs, housing, healthcare, all the rest. All of that is lacking. 1 billion people in the world we live in are on the verge of starvation because of the world food market situation and the fact that we have almost no food stocks left anywhere in the world. You've also got about 2 to 3 billion people right now who are living under €1 per day, under about $1.50 or $2. So Holdren looks at that world and says the reason for poverty is overpopulation. I would say no. The reason for poverty is underproduction of all the main things. Question for Holdren: if you have a bunch of people and you want to give them all a hat and there are not enough hats to go around, what do you do? I say manufacture more hats. Holdren says start cutting off heads. That's Holdren. In being a follower of Bentham and Malthus and Darwin in this administration of fanatics, Holdren is joined by others. Let's look at Cass Sunstein, who is the regulations czar. Sunstein is the pioneer of what is called behaviorist economics. He wants to nudge you or convince you to do certain things. The problem is the nudge is not a friendly nudge. The nudge is going to become a cattle prod, and then it's become a bayonet, and then it's become a machine gun, and God knows what else. That's Cass Sunstein. He's a former law professor from the University of Chicago. Now, he quotes Bentham all the time. Sunstein is a guy who says that animals should have legal rights, including the right to be represented by lawyers in a court. Now, Sunstein, by most people's standards, would be quite extreme. But in the Obama administration, Sunstein is a moderate. Sunstein wants to give legal rights to animals. Holdren wants to give legal rights to trees so that they could be represented by lawyers and they could block development projects because you need more trees. Well, again, I'm all for trees. You want more trees, plant them. During the New Deal, we had something called the Shelter Belt that planted a couple of hundred million trees across the midsection of the United States as an attempt to make the climate better. It was an attempt to deal with the Oklahoma Dust Bowl of the 1930s. The way you do that is to plant trees. Trees are fine, but again, with Holdren, we're going to have trees represented by lawyers stopping human needs from being realized. Generally speaking, the Malthusian, zero-growth, radical environmentalist, ecological extremist movement of the late 60s and early 70s is the precursor that prepares the ground for the radical deindustrialization of the United States in the late 70s and then into the 80s, the so-called Great U-Turn, where the U.S. goes from being an industrial power to being a post-industrial rubble heap. Key moment is 1968 with the foundation of the Club of Rome, Aurelio Pache and Alexander King. Alexander King once admitted that the whole purpose of the ecological movement was to stop the economic development of the Third World and make sure that there would be fewer brown and black people in the world, because this was a problem for the Anglo-Saxon master race, the way he looked at it. 1972, you've got this tremendous work of charlatans and crackpots, Meadows and Forrester, The Limits to Growth, which was that the world really should have ended already because the raw materials are being exhausted at such a rapid rate. So out of that, you get the green movement, the greening of America, and the coming of something that you didn't have before, was a mass constituency for radical environmentalists. In particular, Malthus used to be a dirty word among leftists because he was considered a British imperialist. Marx and Engels had to attack Malthus because otherwise they couldn't function in progressive circles. But by the 1970s, thanks to this, Malthus and Darwin become good guys when, of course, they're really very bad and both charlatans and crackpots. So that's sort of the preparation. You've also got people saying that a service economy is better, the so-called Triple Revolution Committee. You've got the government of Edward Heath in Britain and Harold Wilson of the Labour Party saying quality of life is more important than production. All of these are ways to begin arguing the idea of deindustrialization. The way you get it, though, big time in the U.S., is Paul Adolf Volcker of the Trilateral Commission, appointed by Jimmy Carter of the Trilateral Commission. And what Volcker then does is he gets the Federal Reserve and he raises interest rates to unprecedented levels, a 22% prime rate, meaning that for most people, the interest rates were 30% or even more. And that's for mortgages, for various kinds of business financing and so forth. What Volcker was able to do was to essentially destroy the industrial base of the United States. It became impossible to produce with credit costing that much. Some people compared this to Keynes, right? Keynes said, well, let's have inflation as a cure for depression. And Volcker came back with, no, let's have depression as a cure for inflation. And that's pretty much what he did. He pitched the United States into an industrial depression, which has never ended, wiped out large parts of basic industry, steel mills, chemical, rubber, and all the rest. This is where the jobs went. If you remember Obama's bitter clinger quote, he says, 30 years ago, the jobs went away, and now we have these bitter people clinging to God and guns and anti-trade. Well, how did those jobs go away? That was Volcker. The industrial base of the U.S. was gutted and destroyed by Volcker, and with the environmentalists there, this could be greeted as something good. The resistance to this in the Democratic Party was paralyzed because, well, it's a good thing after all. We won't have any more smokestacks. Well, instead of smokestacks, you're going to have a declining standard of living. And this is what goes together with it. Since about 1967, the U.S. standard of living has declined by two-thirds. And that includes average hourly earnings. It includes the fact that the usual measures of inflation don't tell you how much inflation has been. It's much more because you have to include medical care, insurance, and other things that are not really reflected in the market basket. You're working about 6 weeks more per year. So you've got a longer work day, a longer work week, and a longer work year. Vacations shrink, and the work year is extended by about 6 weeks altogether. The other thing that you've got is your commute is much further, and you're sitting in traffic for a total of about 2 to 3 weeks just sitting there, in addition to whatever the length of your commute would be. If you add all of that together in terms of the burden of economic life on the average standard of living and quality of life, you will find that the U.S. standard of living has indeed declined by 2/3. You can look on shadow government statistics. Their index confirms my finding. It goes from about 300 in the late 60s, early 70s to about 100 today, meaning you've lost 2/3 of your standard of living. So deindustrialization leads to immiseration. It means that the middle class standard of living is destroyed. You've also got more people working. It's not enough for the husband to work. The wife has to work. The kids have to work. The husband has to work 2 jobs, the wife 2 jobs, and all this that everybody knows about. So that is what deindustrialization has done. And that would have been difficult to do without the ideological preparation of green fanatics like Holdren, Ehrlich, Paddock, Meadows and Forrester, the Club of Rome, and collected charlatans and extremists of the 1960s into the 1970s. The disease that we're talking about is not limited to the U.S. Actually, it's really originates in Great Britain with these people like Bentham and Malthus and Darwin. One of Gordon Brown's aides was recently so indiscreet as to say that they were talking about cutting the population of the British Isles by 30 million people. Now, that's way more than Hitler could have accomplished. And what it shows, again, is the anti-human fanaticism, the genocidal fury of the Anglo-American ruling elite, that they hate people and they're determined to exterminate people, and that's what they're into. And if you want to live with a ruling class like that, it's going to be nasty, brutish, and short. The origins of eugenics, racist thinking, race science in the U.S. go back in particular to the Harriman family. Averill Harriman was the son of Harriman, the railroad builder, who had been attacked publicly by Theodore Roosevelt as a robber baron, as a public menace. So Harriman, as a parvenu, new money, who had to go to Oxford and talk to old money, he had a tremendous identity crisis and sense of personal insecurity. So what he wanted to do was to create himself a wonderful race pedigree, that he too was part of the Anglo-Saxon master race. So his wife contributed to this famous gathering at the American Museum of Natural History, which was attended by Nazis as well as British and other race scientists, meaning charlatans and proto-genocidalists, who came together with the idea of improving the race. So U.S. states got into the business of sterilizing people, denying marriage licenses. You have these stories, the Kallikaks and the Jukes in New York State and similar things. The Nazis actually said, the U.S. has beaten us to the punch in terms of eugenics measures. So in some ways, they were actually following in the footsteps of what Harriman and this faction had done in the United States. Now, Bush the Elder, in his first congressional term, when he was representing River Oaks, Houston, Texas, elected in 1966, it was a district that had to be tailor-made, designed for him, as part of a redistricting, so he could finally get elected after he failed to get into the Senate from Texas against Yarborough in 1964. Bush became the champion of eugenics. He brought in Shockley, Herrenstein, and these other fanatics, right? The sort of bell curve school, the precursors of that. In other words, people who talk about racial inferiority of the non-white races and things of this sort. These people were outside the boundaries of respectability because of the backlash against the Nazis. But Bush the Elder did everything he could to make them respectable. He brought them to Congress. He let them lecture groups of members of the House and so forth. So much so that Wilbur Mills, the head of one of the key House committees at the time, coined the term "rubber's Bush," that George Bush the Elder was so interested in contraception for the lower orders that he was rubber's Bush. Now, the idea that I think with Bush the Elder was he believes in the Anglo-Saxon master race. The problem is if you believe in that, you got a problem of numbers because there are so many other people who are not part of this. So what are you going to do? You've got to do something to limit the population growth and probably turn it around among the non-white populations in particular. So I think that is the one thing that Bush the Elder actually believes in as a fixed point of ideology. John P. Holdren, the current Obama population czar, John P. Holdren, the White House science czar, is very much in the tradition of this Harriman eugenics movement, which was rubbing elbows with the Nazis in the 20s and 30s. Things like compulsory abortion, compulsory sterilization, taking children away from parents, preventing marriages, marriage licenses that you have to pay for, implants and other things to prevent birth. This is all in the Nazi or quasi-Nazi tradition of the 20s and 30s. The mentality of oligarchy does not change. We have to remember that as long as there are human individuals, you're going to have the one, the few, and the many. There's going to be one person, small groups of people, and large masses. So this is always going to be with you. These are ontological categories of human existence. The problem you have is if you have the dictatorship of the one, that's a fairly clear-cut problem. If you have the spontaneous mob of the many, that's a problem that people can also recognize. But what you tend to have in human civilization is the rule of the few, the oligarchy, the iron law of oligarchy, studied by German sociologists in the late 1900s. Now, the purpose of an oligarchy is really only one thing. A tyrant can have a project. A mob can have a goal. But an oligarchy is there to do one thing, to perpetuate oligarchy, to give it more and more power and allow it to exist. The mentality of oligarchy always depends on the idea that there's an elite and a mass, and there can't be anything in between. There's really no room for a middle class in oligarchy. So the elite has to justify itself based on what? Why should they rule? Are they smarter? Are they more efficient? Are they better? They're probably none of those things. They're probably inferior in many ways. So they've got to find other ways to justify what is an irrational principle of domination. So oligarchs generally find ways to argue that the mass of people are inferior, that their lives are not worth living, and indeed that they're closer to animals than they are to the elite. So whenever you have an oligarchical elite, they're always going to try to portray the masses as ignorant beasts, inferior, or whatever else it is. And that's what we see. This is very strong in the Anglo-American world. The U.S.-British tradition is not that of a dictator. Stalin, Hitler, this you generally don't find. It's also not so much in the notion of mob rule and demagogy of that sort, although occasionally it is. Generally, what you have in terms of real power is an oligarchy. So this oligarchy is inherited from Venice, from the Venetian Republic of the Middle Ages, and it's transferred into Britain between 1500 and 1600 or so in the form of the Whig Party, the top aristocratic party, which rules Britain from the early 1600s, really, until about 1832 and the Reform Bill. So it's an oligarchical system. The U.S. and the British are a polycentric oligarchy where you can't say the Bilderberger runs it or the Trilateral or the CFR or Bohemian Grove or whatever it is. All of those are power centers that jostle each other and coexist. But what they amount to is an oligarchy. If you have a tyrant, you can convince the tyrant to change policy. It can be done. But to change an oligarchy, as Plato points out, is harder because you've got to convince so many different ones, and as soon as you convince some of them, you've deconvinced others because those are the enemies and they hate the ones that you've convinced. So that's the problem that we face in the Anglo-American world. The Club of Rome is a group of old fascists, for want of a better word. Aurelio Pichet was the most prominent guy. He had been a fascist for Mussolini in the Balkans during World War II, done all manner of crimes there. And then we have his associate, Alexander King, who admitted that embarrassing thing, that the purpose of this was to express the genocide of the Third World. In other words, that it was designed to make sure that there would be no Third World development, that therefore the black and brown people of the world would not become numerous. So the Club of Rome is already the beginning of a genocidal mentality in which Holdren and Cass Sunstein and other people in the Obama regime participate. Naturally, as this becomes more extreme, as the breakdown crisis gets worse, and it is getting worse, as the depression deepens, you get into the definitions of useless eaters, lives not worthy of being lived, non-productive culls, they're called sometimes, surplus population, as Scrooge said following Bentham and Malthus, and how many are there of such people? As the depression gets worse, it gets to be more and more of the population that are useless eaters and non-productive culls. So the problem that we face is the ideology has deteriorated. The global warming ideology is, at least up to now, the most extreme form, because it says that carbon dioxide is a pollutant and that carbon is bad when we ourselves are a carbon-based form of life. So it seems to say that the inevitable results of humanity is pollution, that people pollute, or indeed that people are pollution. It gets back to Ehrlich and Holdren and their idea that humanity is a cancer on the face of the earth. So the ultimate logic of all this is extermination, genocide, the concentration camp, depopulation, and a horror that goes beyond anything seen in the 20th century. That's where Obama is essentially leading. When Holdren is confronted with his published works, the body of work on which his scientific credentials rest, he wants to run away from them and say that he's no longer the environmental extremist that he once was, that his genocidal fury has mellowed with age. But I wouldn't believe that for a minute. It's just that he's become a little bit more sophisticated politically, and he's seen how damaging it is when people throw that stuff at you. It's, of course, a monstrosity that he was allowed to get through that confirmation process in the first place. In terms of genocide, genocide entered the U.S. policy realm in an overt way with this National Security Memorandum 200 by Kissinger in the 1974-75 period, which said that if you have population growth in third world countries, they will compete for the limited natural resources that the U.S. intends to monopolize. I attended the food conference, the World Food Conference of the Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome in December of 1974, which was attended by Kissinger. And I put out some leaflets at this FAO conference in Rome in late 1974. And in response to that, the UN bureaucracy kicked me out of the conference, not for disrupting anything, but simply by pointing out the obvious implications of what was going on. At that same conference, the Soviet delegate made a useful contribution. He said that if you just took the existing off-the-shelf technology and made that available to everybody, you would have no problem with 35 billion people on the earth. The demographic potential is still very, very large, lots and lots of wide open spaces, but they kicked me out. So the Kissinger line was, stop population growth in third world countries, because otherwise they'll compete for natural resources. I guess he's looking into what happens today with Chinese oil consumption and the Chinese in Africa offering their own bids for mining and other products. The other thing to stress is under Carter, and in particular under Secretary of State Edmund Muskie, you had Global 2000 and Global Futures. And that is the real watershed of making genocide, population reduction, euthanasia, population control into the dominant ideology of the U.S. government, the foreign policy establishment, and the State Department. Global 2000 and Global Futures enacted under Muskie are really the turning point, after which U.S. policy in the developing sector is no longer development, but it's rather population control, population reduction, with strong genocidal overtones. Holdren writes books about nuclear target selection, nuclear war. He's a strange love. He's a strange love under green left cover. However, he recognizes what strange loves often forget. You can kill more people with economic means than you can with military means. Robert McNamara did his best to escalate Vietnam. Robert McNamara killed more people at the World Bank than he ever did at the Pentagon. The general estimate is, 40,000 people a day, meaning 15, 20 million a year minimum, die as a result of the IMF conditionalities. They die of starvation, malnutrition, and diseases like diarrhea that can be cured for a few pennies. So that's the cost of the IMF-based system is already in the neighborhood of 20 million dead per year. And again, 40,000 per day. And that's an old figure. Now that we have the depression, it's probably more like 50,000 a day or more, because the effect of the depression is obviously to increase that figure. This is a book called Ecoscience, Population, Resources, Environment. The authors, Paul R. Ehrlich of Stanford University. This is the charlatan with the population bomb. Anne H. Ehrlich, who is an environmental fanatic in her own right. And John P. Holdren of the University of California, Berkeley, today White House science czar for Obama, published by the W.H. Freeman and Company Publishing House in San Francisco. And the edition I have here is 1977, so we're in the Jimmy Carter era. First edition, 1970. Second edition, 1972. And as you can see, this is a hefty tome. This is the best part of 1,000 pages, more than 1,000 pages. If you count the index, we get up to 1,500 pages of raving, insane Malthusian drivel. And he tells you he's a Malthusian, a neo-Malthusian. He loves Darwin. He loves the struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest. And in some ways, he wants to bring that into human society. Now, the heart of the book, I think, for political purposes, has to do with the measures that Holdren proposes to implement as a means of slowing, stopping, and reversing population growth. The heart of the book, I think, starts on page 783, Population Control Direct Measures. You've got to convince people of the necessity of reducing population. For example, one thing he quotes approvingly, a case in point was the sudden imposition in 1976 of compulsory sterilization in some states in India and for government employees in Delhi, following two decades of discouraging results from voluntary family planning. So let's make it involuntary, compulsory, obligatory, and we're going to come in with compulsory sterilization. Let's jump ahead to the involuntary controls. In the 1960s, it was proposed to vasectomize all fathers of three or more children in India. India entertained the policy of compulsory sterilization, and if they had really done it, then they would have been better off, as Holdren says. A program of sterilizing women after their second or third child, despite the fact that this is harder to do than a vasectomy, might be easier to implement than sterilizing men. Other than that, Holdren is interested, and again on page 787, the development of a long-term sterilizing capsule that could be implanted under the skin and removed when pregnancy is desired. Well, this is Norplant, and that's been implanted in victim populations in U.S. inner cities now for a couple of decades. One of the problems is, how do you get it out? The government puts it in, but who's going to help you to take it out? That's a little bit harder. another proposal that Holdren is interested in. He quotes the economist Kevin Boulding, British, I'm pretty sure. Boulding proposed to issue to each woman at maturity a marketable license that would entitle her to have a fixed number of children. And of course, again, if Goldman Sachs gets into the market, then that could be priced out of reach of poor people. He quotes social scientists who have looked into the effects of a marketable license for birth. A very interesting chart on page 788. Baby licenses. We're told that you can have a monthly subsidy if you have no more than two children. You can have a monthly tax on people with more than two children to discourage that. A one-time lump sum tax on excess babies over two. So if you're over two children, that's excess. And quotas for families. So again, the basic idea is some measures designed to persuade, and then the hardcore, hardline measures, compulsory sterilization, compulsory abortion, and it's also a good idea to take children away from mothers if they're teenagers, unmarried, and otherwise not suitable. Now, he wants to impose this not just domestically in the U.S., but even more, he wants to have family planning measures. Here on page 789, he wants to have family planning measures in the less developed countries. High priority should be given to stimulating attitude changes and counteracting the effects of pronatalist traditions. You may remember President de Gaulle of France talked about 100 million Frenchmen as a national goal. Obviously, for Holdren, this is impossible. What are the problems with this? Well, one problem is human rights, page 793. Some people have this idea that there's a fundamental human right for each person responsibly to determine the size of his or her own family. Holdren doesn't like that one. Could this be done in the U.S.? Well, we have the Constitution. Holdren laments, and now we're on page 837. To date, there has been no serious attempt in Western countries, Europe, U.S., Japan, to use laws to control excessive population growth, although there exists ample authority under which population growth could be regulated. For example, under the U.S. Constitution, effective population control programs could be enacted under the clauses that empower Congress to appropriate funds to provide for the general welfare and to regulate commerce. So the Commerce Clause becomes abortion and sterilization. Or for the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. So the idea is strip everybody of the right to exist under the 14th Amendment. Such laws constitutionally could be very broad. Indeed, it has even been concluded that compulsory population control laws, even including laws requiring compulsory abortion, could be sustained under the existing Constitution if the population crisis became sufficiently severe to endanger the society. Few today consider the situation in the United States serious enough to justify compulsion, however, laments Holdren. The most compelling arguments that might be used to justify government regulation of reproduction are based on the rapid population growth relative to the capacity of environmental and social systems to absorb the associated impact. The appeal to greed. To provide a high quality of life for all, there must be fewer people, says Holdren. But there are other sound reasons that support the use of law to regulate reproduction. In today's world, Holdren writes on page 838, the number of children in a family is a matter of profound public concern. There is no individual sphere anymore for a Malthusian fanatic. On page 850, Holdren wants to convert to a spaceman economy. This is not the moonshot anymore. This is the idea that you're on spaceship Earth and everything you have with you is a limited resource. So What you've got to do is reduce throughput of raw materials in industrial processes. He quotes a fellow crackpot, Herman Daly, who has suggested a specific mechanism for accomplishing population reduction. Put strict depletion quotas on the natural resources of the United States, meaning that you couldn't use more than 2 or 3% of the existing oil or minerals or whatever it is. The problem with that is what we've found since the publication of Limits of Growth is that the available stocks of most raw materials have grown. They haven't gone down. They've gone up because you find more than you use. And that, I think, that would be even more clear if this process were not sabotaged. We would want to impose restrictions on the import of manufactured goods. Well, up to a point, but not for Holdren's goals. And there's a big attack on the cornucopians, again on page 851, the American mentality that you can solve things through science and production is something that Holdren wants to polemicize against. And that gets us then to his favorite theme, page 926, the de-development of overdeveloped countries. We've got to stop the less developed countries from imitating the growth path of the developed world. One key to saving world society lies in a measured and orderly retreat from overdevelopment in today's overdeveloped countries, that would be the U.S., a process we will label, for want of a better word, de-development. So if you thought your living standard was too low, Holdren is here to tell you your living standard is too high. You should be de-developed. World government, international controls, the global commons. The quote here is, mutual coercion, mutually agreed upon. The New World Order. It has been apparent for some time that the nations of this planet cannot long survive, we read on page 939, cannot long survive without a system of worldwide controls for dealing with the ecosphere, the world economic system, and world economic growth. Such a system must be above all capable of resolving national differences. This is the basic conclusion of the distinguished professor of international law, Richard A. Falk, as he analyzed the situation, exemplified by the projections of alternative future scenarios. We might enter a plea here for surrendering some national sovereignty to a world government. But it's unfortunately clear that there will not be a supranational government in the foreseeable future. But now 30 years have gone by, and maybe this is within reach at the Copenhagen Conference in December of 2009. So we get the U.S. Environmental Program. And again, in the conclusion, the summary of this is there are two factions on Earth. We have the cornucopians. We can call them the growthsmanship group. The moonshot mentality. Those are people who say science, technology, and industry can solve any problem with political will and the proper effort. And that's pretty much how humanity has survived up to now. But that's the wrong path, according to Holdren. We've got to become neo-Malthusians. On these points, says Holdren, we find ourselves firmly in the neo-Malthusian camp. And again, that's based on Bentham, Ortes, and it's the basis, it's in turn of Darwin. This is a cookbook for the extermination of humanity beyond what he thinks, because the essential predicament of humanity is realize progress or collapse. If you look in historians of world history, like Toynbee, he's got a catalog of, 20 different world civilizations, and they've all collapsed except one. And generally they've collapsed from within, and they've collapsed to a very significant degree because of thinking like this, that there's a limit to growth and that the privileges of an oligarchy are more important than the standard of living and the success of the individual human family. So this is a cookbook for the extermination of humankind, right? Those series that you see on the History Channel. What if there were no people? Well, Holdren has been blazing that trail for quite a while. This is an ultra-Hitlerian genocidalist who's today operating out of the White House in Washington, D.C., and it's time to kick him out. Maurice Strong of Canada is a British imperialist functionary close to Holdren in his outlook in the build-up to the 1992 United Nations conference in Rio. Maurice Strong wrote that the choices between collapsing the entire industrial system of the world and the survival of humanity and the planet. And he's in favor of collapsing the industrial system. So he put out a demagogic call to people that the task of the rest of us is to collapse the industrial system of the world. I suppose George Soros and the people at AIG and Goldman Sachs in the derivatives department were reading all that, because they've certainly taken us pretty far down the road to that. If you collapse the industrial system of the world, the problem you find is that the relative potential population density of the world goes below the existing 7 billion plus people that we've got, and that overhang gets into the danger of extinction. So that's a call to genocide, again, on an ultra-Hitlerian scale, issued by Maurice Strong back in 1992. Holdren is very much in that tradition. Ehrlich and Holdren and their ilk are crackpots, charlatans, and quackademics in the sense that their method is fundamentally wrong. The predicament of humanity is that at any given moment in time, with the existing technology that you have, you face a finite world of natural resources, except that what you can use as a natural resource is already defined by the technology you have. So if you expand your technological repertoire and armory through scientific discovery and technological development, you can define increasing areas of the natural world as usable natural resources. And that's what we've done up to now. If wood is not enough, get coal. If coal is not convenient, get oil. If oil is not enough, get nuclear. If nuclear has problems, get thermonuclear. Look at antimatter. Look beyond. And still beyond, beyond a horizon that we can't even see at this point. The essential human condition is realize progress or collapse, advance in science, technology, and industry, or you will soon cease to exist. And that's the fundamental human premise that this lunatic Malthusian, Darwinian, Benthamite school, Ehrlich, Holdren, and the rest of them deny.